It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
As we mark Earth Day next week, hurricanes, heavy rains, floods, along with drought and raging fires appear to be the norm in the 21st century. Indeed, it looks like climate change is fast approaching with something that is far more noticeable each year. So, what does the future look like? Author Paul Briggs, in his new novel, Altered Seasons, Monsoon Rise, attempts to peer into what may lie ahead for the planet and future generations, and he joins us this morning in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
So what inspired you, by the way, first of all, to write a book, and it looks like it's going to be actually a series of novels, looking at climate change through the eyes of various characters at various terms of society?
Well, it started as a speculation for a novel, for another novel I was writing, or a series of novels set partly in the future. I sort of speculated as to what changes might happen, and then I realized those changes might make an interesting story in themselves. I wrote up another version of it, which I put it on a writer's website, and it was popular. And then I posted on the completed version on my own website, and a publisher saw it. Ron Souter of Secant Publishing suggested that I turn it into a complete novel. So I thought about how it would look from the point of view of various characters at various positions, seeing the whole thing from various angles. And I got started. And
so tell me then, first of all, you concentrate at least initially looking at the polar caps, both obviously the Arctic and the Antarctic. Tell me a little bit about that, because those seem to be the engines for this massive change that takes place and winds up with a winter monsoon, I guess it were.
Oh, yes. It starts with the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. One summer, it drops to zero, basically, that the ocean is completely ice-free. And, of course, it freezes over again in the winter, but, you know, it's not nearly as thick, which means it melts even faster the next year, and the ocean is exposed to the sun for longer, which means it's warmer, which means it takes longer to cool down. The ice cap is even smaller next year. It's sort of a feedback loop. And until for a fairly large portion of the summer, the Arctic Ocean is under a total sunlight, which in turn, and since sunlight absorbs a lot more, that is to say the ocean absorbs more sunlight than ice, which is very bright and reflective. And since obviously the Arctic Ocean gets 24-hour sunlight in the summer, it gets unexpectedly warm and creates these massive, huge, floods, basically, that go in various places during the fall. And That was sort of the idea. I showed it to some people online who knew a little more about the science than I did, and they didn't say it was accurate, but they didn't say I'd made any major mistakes either. They're real scientists. They don't like to speculate as freely as authors do.
Right. So as this ice melts, then what do you see happening then, particularly to with Canada and northern the United States, because you get what you call sort of these northern monsoons.
Yes, they get these massive floods during the fall, and also much heavier snowfall during the winter, which of course all melts in the spring and creates a second series of floods, and because the infrastructure isn't really built to handle that much rainfall and that much snowfall. You get the same sort of problem that they saw in Houston during Hurricane Harvey, where they suddenly got 5 feet of rain. And it's an example of why climate change is guaranteed to be a problem, because everything we have built, like all the crops we grow, where we put our cities, all of it is built on the assumption that things will stay more or less as they are within a certain range, especially sea level.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and there's a plan at one point, the Norfolk plan, to protect the coast, I guess it is, amongst other things. Tell me a little bit about that. And I guess there's a conflict because there are some people who just don't want to give up their seashore homes, as I guess.
Mm-hmm. The plan is basically to build, to spot certain areas that are both valuable and protectable, and build seawalls to protect them from storm surges. And that's supposed to protect them for at least the next 50 years, and which would give later generations time to see what's happening and what's changed and come up with a new plan. Now, there's all sorts of reasons why they can't just protect everything. I mean, there's places like the two examples they cite were Miami and New Orleans, both of which are big cities we don't want to lose, but neither one of which we can protect because Miami is built on limestone, which is porous. You build a seawall and the ocean just goes right under it. New Orleans is, and everything around it is built on silt. And silt, you put anything heavy on it, it compacts. So you put a wall on it, it will sink. And then, so basically doing any sort of plan means a kind of triage. Okay, what's safe, what needs protecting, and what should we just write off right now? And deciding that is actually the easy part. The hard part is going to people and saying, okay, here's what we got to do. And having everyone saying, I mean, we're talking about, because even though the sea level is rising very slowly, you know, mortgages are planned to sell like 20, 30 years down the road. So people see the value of their house dropping to zero because it could be wiped out at any time. I mean,
right, and you have this sort of ripple effect. You talk about blue lining by the banks. That seems to have this social implication. Some people, and I think a couple of individuals actually lose it.
Yes, it's. I mean, I sort of try to look at it from a banker's point of view. Like, do you want to risk being stuck with a property that's going to go down to zero, or do you just write off and basically say, look, here's the deed, but don't come back and try to take out a second mortgage on it. We won't take it. I mean, banks, they do have to think about the bottom line. And I mean, especially in the face of like this massive loss of equity.
Right, right. The other thing, by the way, you describe is the old river control structure, and basically describing about how the Mississippi River has been sort of controlled in terms of where it's going by human beings, and now, in your novel, of course, it collapses.
Yes. If you've ever looked at a map of Louisiana, you notice that long tongue of land right on both sides of the Mississippi River that sticks out into the Gulf of Mexico? Well, that's formed by silt from the Mississippi, of course, and what happens is, over about a 1,000-year period, so much silt builds up. The Mississippi's road to the sea gets so long that at some point there's a flood and it breaks through and it finds a shorter route to the sea. And as I said, it's about a 1,000-year cycle, but the last time this happened was about 1,000 years ago. And about 50 years ago or thereabouts, some people figured out that the next time this happened, the Mississippi would go down the Atchafalaya and hit the ocean at Morgan City. The trouble was, again, New Orleans, it's a big city. It depends on the Mississippi for its drinking water. There's an entire petrochemical industry that depends on that much fresh water. I mean, they just said, no, we can't let this happen. So they built what they call the old river control structure. It's a series of dams to hold in the river and keep it where it is. And so far, it's held up to everything nature can throw at it, including a couple of what we used to think of as 100-year floods before they started happening every 10 years or so. But if there is a big enough flood, eventually it will collapse because, again, the whole thing it's built on top of a layer of silt, and water can just go underneath it, erode it from below, and that's it. And if that happened, I mean, we'd lose New Orleans. We'd lose that whole bank of industries. It would be a lot of, like, gas and oil pipelines would be cut. It would just be, it would be a big blow to the economy. And also, of course, anyone in the path of the Mississippi when it changed course, that would be very bad.
In the book, they don't want to admit that this thing was going to collapse.
It's more that Isabel Bradshaw, the main character, her contracting firm doesn't want to admit that it's running off bad data and that the situation is, and that if you look at it realistically, it makes the situation appears much worse. And so she eventually has to tell the truth in front of her bosses.
Right. I think she loses her job, right?
Yes.
Yeah, she loses her job because of it. There's also international implications. One in particular, obviously, is North Korea. Tell me then a little bit about that and how this climate change kind of undermines particularly authoritarian governments like North Korea.
Part of it is that any small nation is going to be at a disadvantage because the United States and Russia are, and China, they're so big that no one natural disaster is going to take out the whole thing. But of course, North Korea is a very small nation, and massive flooding and famine is a thing that happens there already. And so if you add in a massive flood at the worst possible time, suddenly they reach the point where they can't where they not only can't feed their people, they can't feed their army. And that sort of thing, that's the sort of thing that brings regimes down, is not being able to feed the army. In the West, they first notice this as a problem. They start seeing these incursions of North Korean soldiers into the DMZ, and it turns out they're basically just hunting. They're looking for game. There are things that go wrong because when people start reacting and trying to wean their economies off fossil fuels more rapidly, this means that petrostates start, like Saudi Arabia and Russia, start basically panicking and trying to interfere with the process. And when this doesn't last, it turns out they've basically tried to buy up the entire biofuels industry and shut it down. And when this eventually fails, they still have the same problem they had before, and now they've wasted a bunch of their money. And that's another thing that's very hard on regimes. So,
right. Yeah. You indicated, I think it's Group 77, I think, that that tries to do this. Also, you have this really interesting exchange when the former governor, I guess, Kerry Camberg, visits Israel. They notice, for instance, they're talking about the Israelis creating these sort of heat shelters, but then she looks at the map and says, well, wait a minute. These are in particular places, and it reflects sort of this the current conflict and how you deal with it. Go ahead, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's that was the part I was kind of dreading writing because it's such a thorny issue. I mean, it is. When you have a situation where living space and water and just basic things necessary for survival are likely to be at a premium. I mean, any ethnic conflict is going to be terribly exacerbated by this, and I didn't really enjoy writing about it, but I couldn't see it not happening under these circumstances, or something like it not happening under these circumstances. The whole issue is, it's already such a mess. I mean, like my personal sympathies, if you're curious, are just pick a border and stick with it already.
right.
Like, I get that there's two sides with claims and reasons to be here, but just pick a line.
Right.
That's kind of all I want to say on the Mideast.
So tell me then a little bit about Isabella Bradshaw and her family. And how did you, I assume it's sort of close to home because her family comes from the Eastern Shore.
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew that I was going to need at least a character from the Eastern Shore, preferably more than one. And I also was going to need like someone who was both affected by the problem and understood the problem. So I figured, like an engineer and meteorologist who grew up on the Bay. And I was also somewhat inspired by stories I've heard from friends of mine who they're in a position where they have a whole family, but like there's one person in the family who's earning money and the rest of the family is sort of in a precarious position. And, that's I mean, there's people in that position today, but you know, then you disrupt the economy, you disrupt the climate, and things could, and you know, there could be a lot more people like that. And
she seems to be struggling with A, obviously, how to make a living, although she does that, but struggling with how the society is dealing with this.
She's someone who has a lot of skills, but you know, at the same time, I mean, she's competing with a lot of other people in the same field. And so meanwhile, her family owns a house on the bay that got damaged in a storm. And, you know, the bank, they're one of the people who basically got what they call mortgage forgiveness, which means that the bank says, here, it's yours now. And
right.
only their house is now getting less and less habitable all the time. And they can't get the money together to fix it because they can't take out another mortgage. And of course, the state will take any excuse to knock this property down and just leave it so it's one less place they have to worry about, one less place they might one day have to buy. I mean, she's worried about her family. You know, her sister has a baby and is not really good at taking care of herself. So, and Isabel, she prides herself on her independence, but at the same time, she really feels these ties to these people. And
you also seem to describe the sort of, I mean, eventually they have to leave, but it's sort of like everything begins to disappear. I mean, Smith Island, for example, gets evacuated. And you seem to paint this picture of the shore, which where we live, is almost disappearing in front of our eyes, including an old way of life. I mean, because he's a waterman. I mean, her father's a waterman.
Being a waterman, I mean, it's still viable, except for the occasional algae bloom or such. But but any time you reduce like property values like that, I mean, think what that does to schools. You know, schools run on property taxes. If there's no money for schools, you know, teachers don't want to work there. If the schools are bad, you know, that no one wants to live there. Things go down even further. You know, anything else that depends on property taxes, I mean, the budget for roads, I mean, it's kind of it's another like feedback loop. It's kind of a vicious circle. So it was another thing I did not enjoy writing about was writing about this area being slowly
disappearing.
Disappearing. Yeah. I mean, even the nice old colonial houses you see up in, or well, everywhere really. I mean, you got a nice old house that's well worth living in, but too close to the water. You've got like some rich person who wants to replace their collapsing Audie's McMansion. You got people who know how to basically lift up a whole house and move it. So, I mean, it's not anything I would want to see happen, but I kept picturing it happening and not being able to say why it wouldn't.
You also take a look sort of the conservative response. I mean, you have the president, Henry Pratt. He's actually a conservative Republican. And you have a talk show host, Walter Yushak, who he might not deny climate change, but now he's got another line almost pressed to saying, well, you know, about freedom. I think at one point he's talking to somebody, talking about the government. He says they like nothing better than to declare a state of emergency that lasts for the rest of our lives. And thanks to climate change, that's pretty much what we've got. There's this problem that certainly as a talk show he has, but also Pratt, who's this administrator who's got to be responsible for things. He's got conservative instincts on the one hand, but he's got a problem dealing with all of it on the other.
Yeah, he's Henry Pratt. I mean, normally in fiction, in political fiction, writers try to write about Democrats and Republicans like they're interchangeable because you know that that makes sure that both parties will want to buy your book.
Right.
I don't think that's doable anymore. I mean, but Henry Pratt is sort of, he's almost a steel man Republican, if you like. That is, he's very old school. I almost modeled him after George H.W. Bush. But he sort of became his own character, and he is very competent in his own way. Anyone would be taken by surprise by the scale of the disasters, and he never knows quite how to respond to them, but he's very good at doing other things. And in the case of Walter Yushak, I mean, he is a principled libertarian. I mean, the line that sums him up is, "I'm more afraid of the government than I am of the weather," which, if you look at history as it's happened so far, is reasonable. But but on some level, he knows that what he's saying, that it's purely a natural phenomenon, is not true. But the problem is, he needs it. He needs it to be true, or to act like it's true, because otherwise, I mean, he has no reason not to say, okay, we can do something about this. We need to do something about this. And that opens up possibilities that he just doesn't want to face. I mean, you would rather be at the mercy of natural disasters than...
One of the things that struck me about the book is there were certain elements that reminded me of the Grapes of Wrath. For example, you talk about the camps, right? And there's a quote about someone's talking to someone else and saying, "This is not a concentration camp. I don't care what the news told you. Seriously, look around. You see any guard towers or guards, for that matter, machine guns, big mean dogs. Of course, most people can't escape." And the picture that you paint is very dire in terms of the kind of living conditions. On the other hand, in between all the various chapters, you have this description of the weather. So I'm going to just do a little here. It says, talking about the permafrost, and you say, "Gradually and inevitably, the permafrost began to melt like ice cubes dropped into a glass of water. It cracked as bubbles of gas within it expanded from the relative warmth. Water trickled into the cracks, speeding the melting, and whenever the permafrost melted, the frozen vegetation that had been trapped within it for up to 100,000 years thawed out and began to decay, releasing carbon dioxide and methane." In the Grapes of Wrath, in between various chapters, he would describe what happened to the land. I mean, I don't know if that was necessarily something that you necessarily specifically drew on, but I was really struck by that.
Yeah, The Grapes of Wrath is on my TBR list. I'm very sorry I haven't read it now. That I really should read it as soon as possible. But but it is something I've seen elsewhere. And have you ever read any of George Stewart's?
No.
Well, he did something similar in writing Storm and Earth Abides. He would, Storm is about a very large storm that hits California. And he describes the storm and its effects, and he goes into the flood management system that California uses, and that's in between sections where he talks about the people. In terms of Earth Abides, which is about a plague that wipes out 99.9% of the human race, he talks about the surviving characters and he follows them around, but at the same time, he stops and talks about every human thing, every species that humans domesticated: dogs, cats, pigs, cattle, sheep, and the things that humans have built: roads, cities, dams, and what happens to them, especially in the West, where the story mostly takes place. And so that's kind of where...
It's just almost like another character.
Yes.
In some ways.
Yeah. Maybe George Stewart got the idea from The Grapes of Wrath.
Could be, for that matter. Just a final quote here before we leave. One of the things that struck me is we didn't get a chance to talk about Simcox. She's very wealthy, created her wealth off of diamonds, and there's a party at the very end, and... they're looking back at the new year, looking ahead towards the new year. And she tells everybody, she says, "From our lofty perches, we have looked down on a world fighting a losing battle against chaos. Dread the day when it blights our own lives and fortunes. But the year is over, and here we are, this city, this nation, this world, still here, wiser, stronger, and ready to turn the tide of this war in a new year." And what struck me about it is I felt like, in many ways, what we were seeing are people sitting on the Titanic, clinking their glasses. But that's probably for another segment there. Yeah, and it looks like you're going to be writing some more. We've been talking with Paul Briggs, his new novel, Altered Seasons, Monsoon Rise, which attempts to look at what the future might look like in terms of climate change. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Most in Maryland would not know her name, but Elizabeth Gilman, who ran for office on a socialist ticket, left behind a life of activism. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. She was born in New Haven, Connecticut, on Christmas Day, 1867. Her father became the first president of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where she led a life that saw her push the progressive issues of the day. She earned her degree at the university and became involved in social work. But her activism and experiences led her to become a socialist candidate for governor in Maryland. Ross Jones has written a new biography entitled Elizabeth Gilman, Crusader for Justice, Capturing an Unexpected Activist Life. And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don.
So, well, first of all, what got you interested in her life? And as we were talking, I guess, earlier, this is not a person who people seem to remember.
No, they don't. And for me, it was a happy accident. I was doing research in the archives at Johns Hopkins, and I came across Elizabeth Gilman's name. I'd never heard of her. I didn't know that Daniel Gilman had any children. He had Elizabeth and her older sister, Alice. And so I asked to see the files, and they rolled out a lot of boxes of files. She had given all of her papers to Hopkins in the 1940s. And I started going through them. I spent about an hour or two going through them. Lots of letters, diaries, scrapbooks, pictures. And I said, this is a heck of a story, and I'd like to be able to tell it. And so I started doing more research and writing, and we have a book.
How difficult was it to either find material or maybe perhaps more significantly sort through it all?
Because sorting took a little doing. It wasn't hard to find it, although there's one of the characters in the book named Mercer Green Johnston, and I just by luck found his material. I decided to Google him, found out that there was a huge collection of his papers in Washington at the Library of Congress. I went over there, spent about a week looking at his papers, and we were able to put the two of them together. They had corresponded a lot, and he kept his correspondence with her, and she had none of his with her. So I was able to solve a little bit of a mystery.
So tell us a little bit about her early years, I mean, growing up, and how does that relate, do you think, to what became her activism later on in life?
Well, she was... Her father, Daniel Gilman, was a social activist himself, and he introduced her to social work when she was a teenager. He founded an organization in Baltimore that promoted social work and asked her to take a look at it and see if she would enjoy working at it, and she did, and she went into homes in southwest Baltimore as a social worker, and they were called friendly visitors in those days. And later on trips to Europe, he took her to the East London, the docks of East London, which were very, very poor, introduced her to people there who were working with the poor families of East London. And so it began to take a hold of her. And she worked as a social worker up until about World War I, when she went to France in World War I as a volunteer with the YMCA.
So describe the social movements of the time that seemed to catch her eye. We had the social gospel and that kind of thing. So
the social gospel movement was very important to her. She said that her calling for socialism was really based on religion. That is bringing the charitable aspects of the Christian religion to the community through socialism. And that was one of the moving forces for her in her life. She met this other gentleman, Mercer Johnston, who was an Episcopal priest, and that was his calling also. And so the two of them kind of reinforced each other's interest in socialism.
So how did that play out in her early years then, in terms of what she did?
Well, she was a doer in every social issue that came down the street in Baltimore. She really was the centerpiece for liberalism, social reform, social justice in Baltimore for the first 50 years of the last century. And you name the issue, she was there and working on it. She was involved in raising money for destitute families of striking coal miner workers in West Virginia. She was interested in things like lynchings in Maryland. Went to Congress to testify against lynchings, try to get laws passed, anti-lynching laws. Every issue, Spanish Civil War, she was on the anti-Franco side and lining up people to send money and goods mm-hmm. over to Spain.
So did her experience or her education then lead her then also into this? I mean, is there a combination of her own experience, education, and perhaps her religious beliefs that kind of combine?
I think so. The experience really came out of her church work as a youngster. At Old St. Paul's Church in Baltimore, they had a program called the Guild House program in Southwest Baltimore, and she worked that out of there as a teenager, and so she built on that and then worked in the city and as an adult as a social worker, and then she went off to World War I, and when she came back it was a volunteer with the YMCA, and as she came back, she just jumped into all the issues of the day. And this was 1919, and leading up to the Great Depression, she was involved in all kinds of every aspect of social activity you can imagine.
So what impact did the First World War then have on her?
The First World War interrupted her social activism. But when she came back, I think she was fired up more than ever to get back to work in that field, and she did, and leading up until 1930, when the socialists realized that they had a live wire, and encouraged her, and she accepted to run for governor in 1930.
Now when she went off for the First World War, she was not a pacifist, unlike many activists.
It was really interesting. The Socialist Party was sort of divided in World War One. Hmm. Those who were pacifists and those who went off to war, and she went off to war. When she came back, she was became a pacifist, very ardent pacifist, and said that she never wanted to do anything that would encourage war again. Wrote about it.
So how does she then become involved with the Socialist Party? Because I know she supports La Follette and so on.
Yes, and then I'll go back a little bit to the religious aspect of it.
Yeah.
In 1916, she went to Boston to a religious conference sponsored by the Episcopal Church. She was an activist Episcopalian. And she met a woman there named Vida Scudder. And Vida Scudder was a professor at Wellesley, an Episcopalian activist, but also a socialist. And Elizabeth said that she was fascinated by this woman and learned something from the socialist point of view. She comes back to Baltimore, and a week later, all of the famous socialists of the United States and some from abroad come to meet, have a convention at a place called Sherwood Forest. Maybe you're aware of it, down below Baltimore. And she was invited to attend. And she had more of an introduction to socialism. And she meets this fellow, Mercer Johnston, the Episcopal priest there, and was kind of swept off her feet by his, he was a charismatic, handsome guy, and was singing the same song, if you will, as she was, about the need for churches not to simply preach about doing good in the world, but actually get out and do it and get beyond the church door. And that was something that motivated him and motivated her. He was discharged from his church in Trinity Church, Newark, New Jersey, because he was so liberal. He really was more favorable to the socialists than he was to his own church. And the church father said, we can't take a guy like this. He was saying, get out into the community, bring the community into the church. They were very conservative. They didn't want to do it. And so they fired him. And he then was invited to come down and meet with the socialists at Sherwood Forest. and I think he's probably delighted to do it. Elizabeth meets him there and then decides, since he doesn't have any money, and his wife, he was married, they didn't have any money, that she would be helpful to him. And she had a lot of money. Came down through her father's family. The Gilmans were wealthy people from Connecticut. And so she supported him for a number of years, wanting to get out, him to get out and write and speak and promote the social gospel as she and he saw it.
Mm. So how does she become involved politically with the socialist movement as we
well, they saw. I think the socialists saw her as someone who had been working on behalf of striking workers, helping get food to people who were in need, had been working in Southwest Baltimore with poor families. And they thought, well, this lady is really representing all of the principles that we stand by. And why shouldn't she become our candidate for governor in 1930, and they asked her, and she accepted, nominated up in Hagerstown, and was off and running. Except that she didn't go out on the trail right away. She went to Europe. She went to Europe, and she visited all the socialist countries of Europe. She told a reporter from the Baltimore Sun that she wanted to see what was happening with socialist countries abroad and give Baltimoreans and Marylanders more than just hot air. She wanted to tell them what was really going on.
So did she visit the Soviet Union at all?
She did visit the Soviet Union.
What was her impression?
Her impression was that was a great experiment. I think she called it a great experiment, but that it was not appropriate to the United States.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of campaigner was she when she really gets
there? She was a fascinating campaigner that would never happen today. Here she comes back from Europe and goes to work maybe 6 weeks. That was it. The whole thing was a 6 weeks campaign, and all of her campaigns were short. So, here we're talking about campaigns of 2 years.
Right.
But she did it in 6 weeks, ran all over the state.
Mm-hmm. What kind of response did she get? I mean, was it with large crowds, or do you?
Well, it's really interesting. Who knows? The socialist. There were socialist. A lot of socialist newspapers in those days.
Right.
And the socialist newspapers said that there were big crowds.
Right.
The local regular media said not so many. But so it's hard to tell.
So what kind of what kind of platform was she operating on? And as I was looking at some of them, they almost seem very quaint now.
They do. Things like fair wages,
right.
and Social Security wasn't known at that time. Things that workman's compensation, taxing land values, things that we take for granted today didn't exist then. I think that Franklin Roosevelt really did end the socialists in a way, because the New Deal took over all those issues and made things happen and as you know, got things done that satisfied the socialist points of view.
So, but she is defeated, which is no...
By a huge margin.
Right. But she did set a record here.
She did. Right? She was 150% more votes than the time that someone ran for governor on the socialist ticket before.
Right. Yeah. So once she gets done with that, where does she go in terms of the Great Depression? Because it's hitting a lot of folks very hard. We don't see the trough until 1933, but
she was going to Washington and testifying before congressional committees, urging. There were something like 17 million people out of work at that time, and she was going over there and urging that they put up funds to help people who were out of work.
So and. What was her sense about whether or not the church was doing enough during this period?
She was not happy that she said they weren't doing enough, not nearly enough. And there's a letter in my book that she had written to the bishop of the Episcopal Church of Maryland. She said she'd gone away to go to France in 1917. When she came back, nothing much had changed. They weren't doing nearly enough, and she was pushing him to be more of an activist in social issues.
So just during this period, we obviously have the rise of fascism in
yes.
Europe. She was clearly an anti-fascist. How did that affect her? And yet she was a pacifist, I think, at heart, I think.
Well, she was a pacifist. But there's a story I tell in the book about the the ambassador from Italy named Dino Grandi coming to Baltimore. I'm sorry, coming to Washington, D.C., to visit the State Department. And there was a big protest against a big parade protesting his presence in the country. This is in the 30s. And she wasn't as out front on this subject. And I wondered why. And it turned out that he came to Baltimore after he visited in Washington. And he was a friend of the Garrett family, John Wirt Garrett, who lived in Baltimore, was involved with the B&O Railroad, the family was early on, and had an estate on Charles Street known as Evergreen. And the Grandis were coming to visit the Garretts at Evergreen, probably because they knew each other and met in Rome when Garrett was ambassador from the United States to Italy. But Elizabeth kept a low profile on that one, and I think maybe because of a little too close to home.
So she also then runs, of course, for mayor.
She ran for governor again.
Right.
She ran for the United States Senate twice. She ran for mayor. She even ran for sheriff of Baltimore City. She was always using that platform, always using the platform to get across her social justice, social reform issues, and the principles of the Socialist Party.
And even in her mayoral run, I mean, she still seems to, city-owned dairies and coal.
Oh, absolutely. She didn't vary from that very much at all. But she didn't have much of, the numbers were very small, but she still used that platform to try to make her points.
And also, I guess the Nazis were invited to display their flag at the parade.
Yes, yes.
What was that about?
Well, it was the 300th anniversary, I think, of the city of Baltimore, or was it founding in Maryland? I forget. But there was a big parade, and they had a group carrying the traditional German state flag, and then there was a group wanted to carry the Nazi flag, and she protested heavily to have that removed, and I think she failed. It was carried anyhow.
Right, right. Yeah. Was she concerned that fascism or Nazism?
She was
getting a presence, a foothold in the United States.
She was very concerned about that. On the other hand, she was always a great defender of civil liberties. However, the ACLU branch of Maryland, the Maryland ACLU branch, was founded in her living room on Park Avenue in 1931, and she was always a proponent of civil liberties.
And yes, she was. I guess she attended the Democratic Convention in 1936.
I think she did.
So she's kind of like moving around.
She is. She was a whirling dervish. She was she was everywhere, and she really was the center of liberalism and of social justice, social reform in Baltimore for all that time.
So. The kinds of things that she wanted to do, they were progressive at the time, whether it's civil rights or racial equality. And how, by the way, did she see the issue of race in Baltimore?
She didn't write about it a lot, but she was writing to newspapers in the 1890s, protesting schools for African-American kids that were in very, very bad condition and saying that they ought to do something about them. She had an experience where she wanted to honor the editor of The Nation magazine, Oswald Villard, in 1928. She invited him to Baltimore, and he wanted to give a big party. She decided she wanted to do it at the Southern Hotel, which was the number one hotel in those days, known as the Pearl of Light Street, by the way. And she went to the hotel. They were all set to just with a date, and then they discovered that she was having African Americans as part of the guest list. They said, "Well, we can't serve Negroes. That's against our policy." And so she went to every hotel in Baltimore, and they got the same answer. And so she said, "Heck with this! I'm going to do this at my home." And so she had 100 people at her home, including the African American group. And celebrated Villard's 10 years of service as the editor of the magazine.
What was her sense about equality? I mean, she spent a lot of time, you know, protesting, for instance, the schools issue with resources and that kind of thing. Yeah. How far ahead of where we were was she?
Oh, no. Really, I can't.
I mean, do you have any sense at all?
I really don't have a sense. She's a person of her time.
Yeah.
You know? She went with a delegation to Washington with a Baltimore civil rights leaders protesting lynching in the 30s. And, you know, it fascinated me in realizing that there were several bills that went before the Congress. They never got anywhere, and nothing really happened until the Civil Rights Act of 1964,
right,
where the federal government took a stand against lynching, which is astonishing. She went in 1935 with this group, and the last lynching was in Maryland in 1933. So it was very much a part of her, in her mind and theirs too.
So how did her relationship with Mercer develop? And there seems to be a split, a divide.
Well, it developed, I mentioned, because they didn't, the Johnsons didn't have any money. She did, and she wanted to help them. And they worked together for several years. But then as the Depression came on, money became tight, not for her necessarily, but for other funding resources. And there was one moment where he made an application for a grant from a foundation and didn't get it. And she had a lot of influence with that foundation. And he thought that she had let him down. And he wrote a very, very hot letter to her. She kept her calm and said she was sorry, but that wasn't really the way it had worked out. Nonetheless, he began to fade away. She had bought, he and his wife, a house in Baltimore, if you can believe it. And they decided that he would go to Washington and work in Washington. And so he moved to Washington, and they saw each other a little bit over time after that, but not much. And by the time she ran for governor in 1930, they were not in touch with each other.
Hmm. Did he ever make a living?
He did. He worked for the federal government.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He did. And before that, he was kind of a lobbyist for social justice and social reform causes. But she kind of kept him afloat for a number of years.
Right, right. So her homes, they don't exist anymore.
No, unfortunately, they were torn down. Her house was torn down for a parking lot on 513 Park Avenue.
Yeah. What was the house like?
It was what you would call a great old Victorian mansion. I, of course, didn't see it. I saw a picture of it. And I did meet one gentleman whose parents used to visit her on Sunday for Sunday dinner, about once a month. And he was just a kid when he went there. But he told me about this big dining room, long, high windows, high ceilings, dark wood, a dining table loaded with silver and goblets and all this kind of thing. So it was a different era. It was out of the Victorian era.
You know, sort of, we're talking about really sort of wealthy people.
From that period.
Yeah.
From that period, yeah. And she could have, you know, I believe she could have just coasted on her wealth if she wanted to and traveled all the time. She traveled a lot, but she could have traveled all the time. But she at some point early on in her life, she was gripped by this notion of helping other people through social work.
I think at a testimonial dinner, there was a quote I ran across, I think it was in your book, about I worked with organizations that were not radical in the best sort of way, but they were not getting at the roots of things. Socialists want a better place for everyone to live.
Right.
Is that her legacy?
I think it is. I think it is. Yeah.
So we know about her now. There's at least one book. Why do you think she has disappeared from our consciousness?
I think she disappeared primarily because she didn't do any writing herself. The woman I think I mentioned earlier, this woman Vida Scudder, who was at Wellesley College and was a socialist and a religious reformer, did a lot of writing, a lot of speaking around. Elizabeth was much more of a doer. And she did her thing, and then she moved on. And I think the problem is she didn't leave a lot of material that in the public eye that people can refer to. So I hope that I've helped get a little bit out about her so that people will have an understanding and an appreciation. In her day, she was a big deal in Baltimore.
I mean, you talk about how that she was front page news.
She was. And they covered the press covered her, all the papers covered her. All trips abroad, when she came home, what she did, it was an amazing. She was a character. She was a character, but the Baltimore Sun in its final tribute to her in an editorial said that she was just a character of the highest order, and. And someone that they mourned the loss. The city mourned the loss of Elizabeth when she died in 1950.
I mean, it doesn't seem as if she, in her relationships, that she was necessarily approached them in an angry sort of way. I mean, there was the Obit quote. I think it was from some, but said that she had the ability to prod people,
exactly.
Usually agreeably, to think.
Exactly. Yeah. No, she wasn't. She wasn't. She was restrained. It's so different from today. No yelling and screaming that I can have seen in her papers, but restrained and but driven. She was driven. There's no doubt about it, to accomplish what she wanted for her religious beliefs and her social beliefs.
So when we look back on her, is there something that you think you came to appreciate about her? I mean, obviously, this is not somebody who was in the forefront when you started out on your journey here, but and what kind of impression did she leave with you?
She left an impression of a devoted social worker. I call her a social worker on steroids. Hmm. I mean, someone who really cared about people, men, women, children of the working community, of the working classes. And she did her best to help him in any way she could.
What do you think she would have thought of where we are today?
I think she would have been distressed. I think she'd been distressed. And she'd been going down to Washington just like she did back then, pounding her fist and making sure people listened.
Mm, but in an aristocratic, restrained way.
Yeah. In a reasonable way.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with Ross Jones. He's written a new biography entitled Elizabeth Gilman, Crusader for Justice. Really captured, I think, an unexpected activist life. She, of course, was the daughter of the first president of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Earned a degree as the university became obviously involved with social work. But she was an activist both politically and socially.
Yes, she was.
Well, I appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.